Lung cancer has recently made a great deal of clinical research progress integrating biologic agents into systemic management in the metastatic setting, and new trials are evaluating a variety of strategies in earlier stage disease. I met with Dr. Roman Perez-Soler for his take on these developments, and he began our conversation by commenting on VEGF blockade, specifically with bevacizumab.
Obviously, the introduction of anti-angiogenesis agents was received with some skepticism by some. And as always happens, at the beginning of a new drug, maybe a lot of emphasis was put on some horrendous toxicities that do not happen to be as horrendous or very rare. So there were people that jumped on it right away and were convinced with one trial, even if the clinical benefit is modest. But there was a lot of people that were saying that the results are modest, we need a second trial, this is not cost effective, etc.
By the second trial, do you mean the AVAIL study?
The AVAIL study. So the AVAIL study came at ASCO, and it shows again that there's no question that Avastin is adding something to a different chemotherapeutic regimen. But obviously, what everybody wants to see is whether there is also a survival advantage. So I think that's one of the things that people are waiting for. There is an improvement in response. There is an improvement in progression-free survival. And the hazard ratios are pretty good, but not as good as in the ECOG 4599. But we don't know the survival data. And people would want to see that. Some people still want to see that, you know, as part of the acceptance of this new modality.
Can you review the chemotherapy backbone of those two studies and what your take is right now on what regimen or agents are reasonable combined with bevacizumab?
Correct. So, you know, initially the whole anti-angiogenesis field was, or the premise was, that these would work independently of the chemo you use. And I think we're starting to see that maybe that may not be true. There are better chemotherapies than others. So, for example, gemcitabine and cisplatinum may not be as good as a backbone. There has been a study, I think, in pancreatic with gemcitabine, with Avastin, the bevacizumab, that did not meet, I think, a survival endpoint. And there was a study in mesothelioma also with gemcitabine and cisplatinum plus minus that. So there has been the sense that maybe gemcitabine is not as good. Other people have said that, and we knew that, that some chemotherapeutic agents, particularly the taxanes, are actually toxic to endothelial cells. So they have a blood vessel destructive effect. And that may help, obviously, an anti-angiogenic agent. And that might explain why maybe a taxane base, at least in lung, is better. So as a result of that, it seems that for bevacizumab, at this point, what our intuition is telling us is probably a taxane-based regimen is probably better. But again, you know, the data is coming up like on a monthly basis.
So you're kind of drawing an indirect comparison there between AVAIL with cisgem versus the ECOG study with paclitaxel carbo.
Correct. It's all speculation at this point because we don't have all the data on the AVAIL. I think the AVAIL is being a very important study because it has pointed to the fact that maybe the dose is something that we should reconsider even with a Taxol-based regimen. I think most of the oncology are convinced that anti-angiogenesis strategy adds something. It's more impressive in colorectal. It's maybe not as impressive in lung, but at the end of the day, from a patient perspective, my personal experience has been really no problems giving Avastin to patients.
Specifically, you mentioned the concern in terms of serious issues, which obviously in lung cancer is hemoptysis, and you alluded to the fact that maybe that's maybe been kind of overstated a little bit. What's your take on the data, and how do you go through this with patients?
Well, in my experience, I have not seen any hemorrhagic event. It may be that the people that see those are less selective. I don't know. I don't think I am very selective or very non-selective. I'm probably more in the middle. I'm willing to take some risks, even some central lesions. certainly somebody with HEMOP disease and squamous histology, I will not treat, and I have not treated. And if the histology is questionable, I think I will not treat somebody where I suspect that maybe this is not an undifferentiated non-small cell, but maybe squamous carcinoma. I have not seen any real problems in terms of hemoptysis. I've seen some hypertensions that are easy to handle. I have not seen anything that impressed me in terms of thromboembolic events. So I think from a patient perspective, even if the data is not completely solid because it's all work in progress, I have no doubt that for the patients it's good to give them the regimen of 4599 at this point.
When you actually discuss this with a patient who wants as much information as you can give and they turn around and say to you, of course, obviously it's going to be different in different situations, but you know, what's your take on what's the risk of a serious or fatal bleed? What number do you give to them, or do you give them a number?
I will tell them that it's 2% in the study in America and 1% in the study in Europe, and they have not seen any of those things. And obviously those studies included many, many centers, different doctors, how well selected the patients were. You know, we know that in these international multi-center studies, there may be a less scrutiny sometimes on what type of patients are entered. The brain metastasis becomes another issue because now we're doing MRIs all the time and we're finding little things. So now, for example, I just saw a patient today who is a non-small cell and initially was misdiagnosed as a small cell and was given carbo-VP16 and from the very beginning has had two tiny lesions in the brain that in all reports are being said to be most likely metastasis. So now that the pathology has been changed to a neuroendocrine non-small cell type of lung cancer, we're going back to using frontline therapy or therapy for non-small cell. And the question was whether we should treat her with Avastin. And she has had these two lesions for 6 months that all the reports say most likely metastasis.
Treated?
She didn't receive radiotherapy. So these have not moved, whereas the disease in the chest has grown somewhat. It's obviously biologically, the reason the pathology was reviewed is it was not behaving as small cell. And they reviewed it. And actually, they went to MD Anderson for review pathology. Now we have confirmed here also. She's been one of these patients that's been around many doctors.
Smoker?
Smoker.
How often do you see a change in diagnosis from small cell to non-small cell?
Not very common. And in generally, the change happens when patients are in small community areas when maybe the pathology is not as good. So anyway, now we have a person who is most likely non-small cell, relatively indolent, got some response with carbo-VP16 and had these two lesions in the brain that all the reports say is probably brain metastasis. So ideally, I would like to treat with the carbotaxel Avastin. But obviously, I have the problem with these two brain lesions. And I've told the patient that this is a risk. If something happens, we have to make a decision. Although I see that in discussions we have with the experts, that I think we're starting to be more relaxed regarding brain metastasis. There's a lot of information on gliomas treated with Avastin, no bleeding. There's very little heard about bleedings in the brain with Avastin in people that we didn't see the metastasis, something happened. So I think people start to be more relaxed about it, but still, it's hard.
Have you done it yet?
I've done in patients where we have had a resection or the two lesions have been treated with radiosurgery or we have done something previously to the lesions with the patient understanding that there might be a slight more risk of bleeding, you know. I have found that most patients, when they are given the objective data, they don't have a problem to sign for Avastin. I haven't had people that say, I don't want this because I'm scared of having massive hemoptysis. So I think that now the other thing is whether how many people qualify or meet the criteria for that. If you go very strict and look at the eligibility criteria of 4599, well, then you are going to find you have to have a PS of 0 to 1 and no hemoptysis, etc. And then when we have seen some retrospective analysis on the elderly, that doesn't look as good. So if you are negative about it, there are always reasons not to give it. And then that type of physician will give it or will say that only 10 or 20% of his patients qualify. Somebody who is enthusiastic about it will say 67%. I think the number is probably 30 to 40% qualified. But that leaves 60% of patients frontline that still are going to be on chemo alone, you know. And that's where the new data or the new press release on the FLEX study, the Erbitux study, with cisplatin and vinorelbine is triggering curiosity, because that shows that it's clearly clinically positive. That means that maybe we have a regimen of chemo plus a targeted agent for the non-Avastin candidates.
What specifically did that trial look at?
That trial looked at Erbitux added to cisplatin and vinorelbine. And as you know, all these trials of chemotherapy plus an EGFR inhibitor had been negative, including IRESA 2 trials, Tarceva 2 trials, and then there was one with Vectibix or panitumumab, small, but it was carboplatin plus that antibody, negative. And then there has been also a carboplatin plus minus cetuximab, negative. And now, from Europe, as a result of an initial phase 2 study on cisplatin and vinorelbine plus cetuximab, they've done this randomized phase 3, and they did the press release that the study has met the survival endpoint. And nobody knows how much is the difference. And everybody's speculating. This came as a surprise to all the experts, where we have seen that we don't expect much to happen when you add an EGFR inhibitor to chemo. Now, is that because it's a different chemo? We don't know. Is that because it's an antibody, which has a different pharmacology? We don't know. We don't know the magnitude of the benefit yet. But if the magnitude of the benefit is 2 months, which seems to be a number that is accepted as clinically, it could be then an alternative for the non-Avastin candidates who receive only chemotherapy.
What about the regimen of pemetrexed and carboplatinum, either alone or with bevacizumab? Where do you see that heading?
I think you touch really on one of the good stories. You're talking about the last year. So I think the stories were the AVAIL, now the FLEX, and the third story is the results shown in Korea of cisplatinum Alimta against cisplatinum gemcitabine frontline, showing what we had anticipated, equal effect, less toxicity. And interestingly also, a better effect in adenocarcinomas or in the non-squamous, less of an effect in non-squamous. So the population that is the Avastin population. So the reaction immediately of everybody was, you must add Avastin here to show that you are getting the 2 month effect on top of it. And then you have a winner. It's less toxic. Now you show that Avastin works with you. And in addition, this is better in adenos than squamous, which is the population we have to treat with Avastin. I'm sure that was the reaction of most people, you know. My reaction to Alimta has always been one of, I would say, happy surprise to see how such a non-toxic agent really is useful for the patients. It's rare to see any side effect with these drugs, really like the least toxic of all the agents we have. And we see stable diseases and responses that allow us sometimes to continue for a long time this therapy. So to see that frontline as a less toxic, non-alopecia, less myelosuppressive regimen, I think is good news. And my gut feeling would be that something is going to be good for the patients frontline, because I think they're going to have a much better experience with frontline chemotherapy.
Frontline being cis or carbo with
pemetrexed? Well, that's going to be the thing again, you know. I've never been very excited about the cis against carbo dilemma. And I think most people in the metastatic disease are like me. They really don't think it's much of a difference. It's palliative, carbo is less toxic, you know, forget about 2 more weeks, 2 less weeks. The discussion comes when we're in the adjuvant setting, when we all know, and from animal experiments to everything, that if there is a winner, cis is the winner. And if the winning in the adjuvant setting means 1% point, that is translated into life. So that's where some people have been very strong on the adjuvant and said, you know, for the situation where we don't cure anybody, that's okay. But for a situation where curability is possible, even a 1% difference in such a common disease may be actually real lives. And that's why in the adjuvant study with Avastin, as you know, carbo was, in a way, eliminated.
That was the ECOG study that just got activated in the last
1505,
few months.
Right. I think. It took 1 year or more to get started. And as you know, there's a selection of three chemos, all cisplatinum-based, plus minus Avastin.
And that's docetaxel, gem.
And navalbin.
And navalbin.
Because, you know, most of the experience in adjuvant is navalbin cis, which is a regimen that the Canadians use, Europeans use. In the U.S., we really don't use much of navalbin cis. And now it's coming as the best data for adjuvant is navalbin cis. And now with the FLEX study with Erbitux is positive, then navalbin cis may come back as a backbone of chemotherapy that in this country, if we look at the polls, probably navalbin cis is number four of the regimens. No, first will be carboplatin, gem, cis, taxotere, cis. Maybe finally it's navalbin cis.
Yeah, we've looked at that in our patterns of care studies, and by far it's carboplatin on the adjuvant setting, which ironically is not allowed in the ECOG study.
Correct.
What are you doing right now in non-protocol? Are you putting patients in the ECOG study?
We are about to start.
What about your non-protocol approach to selection of regimen?
I've been using gem cis, gem carbo also. And I can use also carboplatin. I mean, I've not been so impressed or into the fight of the carbo against cis. But the desire, obviously, is to just put the patients on study. And unfortunately, as you know, every day it takes longer to open a study. And this study should have been open 1 year ago. And now it's approved, but still, for example, our center is IRBs and the different committees. Once I guess everybody's on, we should accrue very fast because I think, because we don't know what we're doing, we're going to all enroll our patients on the study. That's the idea.
But for you, using carbo in the adjuvant setting, is it going to be difficult to say, okay, how would you like to go in the study getting cis, but if you don't want to go to the study, you're going to get carbo?
First of all, I think that people that qualify for the study will all get in the study because the reality is going to be that they will have 50% chance of getting Avastin.
Right.
So it's in their interest to get into the study. I mean, this, at the end of the day, is an interesting drug that has activity and therefore why they shouldn't be on the study.
And certainly in colon cancer, the NSABP trial accrued 2,600 people, their adjuvant Bev trial, in 2 years. So there was the same thinking there. You mentioned the AVAIL study looking at dose because they looked at both the 15 milligrams as well as the lower 7.5 milligrams. And although the trial wasn't designed to compare those, it seems like everybody is. What are you doing in your practice off study right now?
I give 15 carboplatin. I don't want to take the risk using another chemo in a lower dose. If I had survival data with 7.5 with gem-cis that was similar to carboplatin, at this point I think most physicians will use carboplatin and 15 until more data becomes available.
What are your thoughts about the combination of bevacizumab and erlotinib?
I've always been positive on that. Obviously, I was early on erlotinib. I have always been, if you want, a babysitter that loves the kit. But I think the data that has been generated so far is encouraging. There had been the study that Roy Herbst initially did with Allen. I think it was 30 patients. You know, with all adenos, but the survival was a year. In BR21, the survival is 8 months for that group. And then the other study of Ehrenbacher randomization is also 30 patients per group. The trends are always that Avastin is adding something. And obviously, if this was a second-line combination of two non-chemotherapeutic agents that was superior to one single agent like Taxotere or Alimta, that would be good news. But it's possible also that Avastin adds to Alimta too. So that's what the Ehrenbacher study also showed, that probably you could also combine Alimta with Avastin on second line and have a better regimen. But the main discussion here is going to be that the candidates for Avastin get it front line. So once you get to second line, if they already failed front line and front line contained Avastin, who has the guts here to keep pushing Avastin without data? The scientists are going to tell you that the fact that a tumor grows while you are on chemo plus Avastin does not mean you are resistant to Avastin, does not mean that Avastin cannot sensitize to a new chemo. But again, you know, the doctors are a little bit skeptical. They would like to see data based on that. That's why the studies that Genentech now has, these, I think, the Betalong. The Betalong is the big study of Tarceva against Tarceva Avastin. But it's only in people that never received Avastin frontline. It's probably going to be positive. That would be my, if I had to bet on something. But then the question is going to be how relevant this study is in my practice, because all the patients on the study had not received Avastin frontline. And I think many people will say, it doesn't mean anything to me. You have to show to me that Avastin second line in people that receive Avastin frontline still is a good drug.
I guess the one scenario I've heard people talk about is the patient who, let's say, is a non-smoker or for some reason, you know, is a gene mutation tumor who gets started out on chemo, Bev, carboplatin, and then has the chemo stopped and is continued on the Bev and then progresses after having a pretty good response. Mm-hmm. So the question is, at that point, do you keep the Bev going and add in orlatinib? What do you do?
That's a reasonable thing to do. Because, you know, from a point of view of the patient, I mean, let's look from the point of view of the patient. I'm a non-smoker. I know orlatinib is a good drug for me. I know I'm going to get it sooner or later. So for the patient, if you propose something to a patient that represents minimal risk to him and a potential advantage, he's going to go for it. So you tell him, yeah, you had Avastin initially. You responded. Now the disease is progressing on Avastin alone. Okay, that's not surprising because this drug does not prevent tumor cells from growing. This drug only prevents tumor cells of developing their own vessels or, if you want, delays that process. So the fact that you have progress doesn't mean the drug doesn't work. What we need here is something that will kill your tumor. So I'm going to put orlatinib, which is good for you. But I think that Avastin should be continued because, if anything, the worst scenario is if it doesn't do anything, it doesn't cause any harm. And the best scenario is actually helps Tarceva. So obviously, from a patient point of view, I would add Tarceva on top of Avastin, particularly when I know that Avastin Tarceva on second line looks pretty promising because there's nothing for the patient to lose.
How do you approach first-line therapy in non-smokers or mutation carriers?
Good question. Yesterday at the, you know, we have every year here in New York, this New York Lung Cancer Symposium, so we had a case precisely that. And the opinions that were given were from Vince Miller and Nasser Khanna, Raftopoulos, and Abe Chachua from NYU, and myself. So the thing was, how do you, a non-smoker? As you know, the subset analysis with carboplatin and Tarceva was very positive there, the subset on the non-smokers. As a result of that, for example, the Memorial Group, and also myself, have used this combination, carboplatin plus Tarceva, as frontline therapy in non-smokers. Now Avastin came in. And what probably most people think that the logical thing to do is give carboplatin Avastin, and the day there's progression, you are Tarceva in the way you were saying. However, you can be more aggressive. You can say, let's try to get a mutation analysis, and if it's mutated, I'll give you Tarceva alone. And it only takes 6 weeks for me to know if it works or not. And if it doesn't, I'll give you the carboplatin Avastin. And the most aggressive will be, let's go with the subset analysis, carboplatin, Tarceva, and add Avastin on top. So you see, it depends how creative you want to be, but today I think you could give carboplatin, Tarceva, and Avastin to a patient. Has anybody done that? Very rarely, because even the ones who believe in putting Tarceva, carboplatin were a little bit shy of now putting all these four drugs together. But it may not be a bad strategy for a non-smoker, and certainly nothing for the patient to lose, you know.
I mentioned we were talking about the idea of the chemo, carboplatin, bevacizumab. Do you generally stop the chemo and continue the bevacizumab?
Yes.
And you keep it going until progression?
Yes.
What were your thoughts? I don't know if you're familiar with the data that was presented at ASCO in colon cancer of the BRIGHT tumor registry by Axel Grothy, which suggested that maybe continuation of bevacizumab in colon cancer and progression, there was some advantage to it. It generated a prospective randomized study they're doing now to look at that. What were your thoughts about those data and sort of in general where you think we might be heading with that kind of strategy?
I have heard of the data and I share the concern from many physicians that the most obscure potential contribution of Avastin is this maintenance thing. Most people will say the response rate is higher and the PFS is longer. Therefore, I know that Avastin is helping my chemo. However, I have no clue what maintenance Avastin does because the drug by itself does nothing. So I think that if you ask many people what's the trial we need to do with Avastin, one of the top trials is going to be I want a trial of carboplatin Avastin with maintenance against carboplatin Avastin, no maintenance. It is true, and I heard that yesterday actually, that in colon there is some data suggesting that actually the maintenance phase is not trivial, may add something. In lung, I have no idea. We don't have that data. The trial, as I think Nasser Khanna said yesterday, should have been a three-arm study. Carboplatin, carboplatin-Avastin, carboplatin-Avastin plus Avastin maintenance. That would have been the perfect trial.
And actually, in breast, they're doing that in adjuvant, which I think is the first time I've seen that. And just to finish out on adjuvant, we were talking about selection of therapy, but what about the selection of patients to be treated, and specifically the 1Bs? And I was curious what your take on the recent paper that came out with the ASCO guidelines or approaches to adjuvant therapy in general, and specifically related to that issue.
Well, you know, at the end on the ECOG 1505, they took the 1Bs that are larger than 4 centimeters because of the subset analysis. Yeah, that's a tough thing because the CLGB study initially was positive and then was negative, as you know. My take is that that's a not very large study either, and maybe with more patients it would be positive. You know, that's the thing that we always... That study is not very large.
I thought it was kind of weird, as I understood it, that at one point they stopped it because it was too positive, and then the trial turned out to be negative. It just, I kind of wonder about what the stopping rules were or what happened.
Yeah.
There. What was your take on that?
My take was one of, I don't understand what's going on, but I look at the total number of patients and I'm not a statistician, but I see all the time these big trials. And it seems to me that in the world of big trials, this is not such a big trial. Therefore, it may be that there is a signal there, but because of the number of patients is not big enough, we are losing. But in any case, patient with 1B comes to you, what you have to do with a patient like this is tell, listen, the best evidence for adjuvant is 2 and 3A. There may be that in 1Bs also it helps, and probably in the 1Bs more than 4 centimeters. But all these are really things that we have organized in this very structured world, and today we believe that's the way, that's the policy. I think if you are very honest with patients, actually, that some of them are going to say they want adjuvant therapy, even with 1B less than 4 centimeters. I mean, if you're 3.5 centimeters, something like that, come on, what's the... So, and I have given chemotherapy adjuvant to people like that. And I don't have much of a problem.
You mentioned the Radiant study. Can you review what that trial is looking at and what your take is of the issue of erlotinib or EGFR TKIs in the adjuvant setting and the issue of rash?
Correct. So the Radiant is looking at a study of adjuvant chemotherapy followed by Tarceva for 2 years. It selects patients. You have to be EGFR positive by immunohistochemistry or FISH, I think. So it eliminates EGFR negative patients. The endpoint, I think, is survival. I think selecting is right. Whether they are selecting enough, I don't know. Maybe a selection by FISH only would have been better. However, it might be extremely difficult to do a study adjuvant by selecting by FISH. You would need to centralize and do the FISH, and only 30 or 40% will be positive. The more you select in these trials, the more likely you are going to find a positive result. But at the same time, then you may exclude patients that may benefit, and the longer it's going to take to do the study. Like it's being shown now in Europe, they're trying to do a frontline study in mutated tumors with erlotinib alone against chemotherapy. And that's going to take probably forever. So I think the Radiant is a good study for anybody who's EGFR positive. Would I recommend the patient go on the Radiant or do the adjuvant Avastin? I mean, if somebody's clearly EGFR positive, I think it's a good study to go on the Radiant. Now, the issue there is going to be whether somebody can take 2 years off Tarceva and that be tolerable in terms of toxicity. And I think it's going to be tolerable for most patients. The first 2 months may be rough, but as you know, the majority of people after 2 months of Tarceva start having toxicity subsidus. So the skin rashes tend to be better. There's always going to be a minority of people that need a reduction or will not tolerate or will come to the office and say, I cannot do this. We did this when still the drug was not approved. I put some patients that were clearly the non-smokers fully resected on Tarceva. And I remember a couple of patients that came and said that they couldn't do it. It was rough on them to take
it. Cosmetic or symptoms or both?
Symptoms.
What did you do to try to prevent or treat it?
Well, as you know, this is an area where there has been little attention. I think everybody recognizes, particularly at the beginning of using these drugs, the nurses, that this is a problem and they don't know what to do. I myself, and everybody's different, We'll use a moisturizer without alcohol or perfume, and we'll use tetracyclines, oral tetracyclines. There was, I think, a study at ASCO that showed that the incidence of rash with tetracycline was not lower, but there seemed to be less grade 3s or severe rashes. I don't use topical steroids. I don't use topical Elidel and those things. We used at the beginning, I had several patients that it seemed to me that topical steroids were making things more complicated. So I will use a moisturizer and the tetracyclines, and if it gets to the point patient cannot tolerate, I'll reduce the dose or stop for a week.
Anything coming down the pike? You published about vitamin K3. What's
correct.
The deal there?
Well, you see, what we've tried to do, my interest in Tarceva has been now for more than 10 years, and what we realized is that the rash was an important problem, but very little research was being done. So we developed this idea that if you block the phosphatase, which controls the phosphorylation of the receptor, then the receptor is constantly phosphorylated. So if I put a phosphatase cream on your skin, what happens, the receptor is constantly activated, and it's much more difficult for Tarceva to inhibit that receptor. So I can rescue with such a compound the skin only because it's topical, and hopefully it will not be absorbed and rescue the tumor. So we developed that, and there's a company, HANA Biosciences, who is developing that, is going to start a clinical study, which will consist basically in proof of principle to treat half the body with the cream and the other half, which is a placebo or moisturizer, and see whether we can prevent the rash. And that would be something that is not treating the inflammation, but is treating really, or it's like the folic acid with methotrexate. It's trying to rescue the effect of the drug from the skin.
Anything new about why the rash does predict for a response?
Well, we have been speculating, and there have been two theories, that the rash means bigger exposure to the drug. I personally don't think it's that. I think the rash occurs in individuals that have a better immune system and a better shape. That's my opinion. And as a result of that, you see these tremendous rashes on individuals who already have a better prognosis. It may be the two things together.
At the ECHO meeting that just occurred in September, there was a presentation of the so-called INTEREST trial.
Yes.
Looking at gefitinib coming back again versus docetaxel. Can you talk about that study? It was kind of a surprise.
Very interesting study in my mind. It was presented also in Seoul in Korea. So the good news on EGFR, I think, for the year is that Tarceva was here and seemed to be the winner. And now Erbitux with the Flex may come in. And IRES is coming back. So I think that's interesting. So IRES is coming back because when you randomize against a standard of care taxotere, and this has been done in a population that is European and some Orientals, what has happened is that they meet the non-inferiority.
And this is the second line.
And the response rate of IRES in the Orientals obviously is higher and taxotere is less. So the curves are exactly the same. So it meets the non-inferiority criteria. But the most interesting thing for me was that when they look at the subsets, the non-smokers and the fish and everything, you would have predicted that, well, at least they found the subset where the IRESA was better or taxotere was better. Well, they couldn't find that. They find that all the subsets that we traditionally have identified as good for EGFR inhibitors were also good for taxotere. So it was obvious that the non-smokers also do better with taxotere and the fish positive also. So that was mind-boggling because it seems that we have been talking about these non-smokers and all these things for years, and maybe now we have to go back and realize that maybe these, rather than predictors, are actually prognostic or predictors for a lot of things.
Do you think that this study is going to sort of reawaken interest in gefitinib?
That was a topic of a discussion at the meeting that we had in New York about 6 weeks ago, and I was asked that question, and there was Chandra Balani there and Paul Bunn. My opinion was that Alimta was approved on a similar study. Alimta against taxotere, less toxic, same efficacy, approved. Conditional approval. This little even better is IRES against taxotere, non-inferiority, less toxicity. It should be approved, in my way of thinking. However, because this trial apparently was a requirement from the original submission, so the story is a little bit more complicated because it's a big file of IRES at the FDA. And I don't know if the FDA will take a drug based on a non-inferiority study that competes with a drug that we all believe is very similar, which is Tarceva. But it seems to me that I don't know. If it was to me, I think that the data suggests that IRESA deserves, because we don't have that data for Tarceva, that is, there's no inferiority with Taxotere, you know?
What has been looked at in terms of Tarceva versus, for example, docetaxel and second?
Well, there is that study. The only study, which I think is also a requirement of the original submission for Tarceva, was, I think, the Saturn or Titan, where they take patients that progress on frontline chemo and they randomize to Alimto Taxotere against Tarceva. It's a little different. You don't wait till they relapse. While on frontline, if they do not respond and progress, you randomize. But that's the only data we have of, or we will have, on Tarceva against chemo.
A couple questions about new agents. What are your thoughts about ZD6474 or Zactima? Where are we and where do you think that's heading?
Well, that's the dual inhibitor. And we have been discussing now for some time what is better, to have a drug that is very good at one thing and so-so at the other thing, or you want the two drugs that are best for each target. The reality of Zactima is that it's an EGFR inhibitor, an anti-angiogenesis inhibitor, but it is not the best EGFR inhibitor by itself, and it's probably not the best TKI for angiogenesis. So you are basically having a drug that has some merit by combining two functions, but in a very competitive world may find that cannot make the mark, because somebody's going to combine the two worst enemies of Zactima as a combination. So that's the thing. And some of the data has met the endpoints of progression-free survival. But it seems that with all these new avalanche of agents, the 2171 seems to be a very nice, potent anti-angiogenesis compound. So why not compound like that with the Tarceva rather than Zactima? So I would say that although the approach is meritorious, in the real world, the competition may be too tough for that type of drug.
What about nab-paclitaxel? We've seen increasing use of that in breast cancer. Where are we with lung cancer?
We have not used those, although there has been some phase 2 data suggesting promising activity. I have not used it, but I think it was RISV from Memorial that published a phase 2, and I have seen some data suggestive that we may be dealing similar situation in breast. There is a number of things coming up, mainly a variety of new anti-angiogenesis agents. They are all being tested frontline with carboplatin, sorafenib, sunitinib, etc., etc. But they are the new targets. So the IGFR1, the insulin growth factor-like receptor, is another of the signaling pathways. And now we have the agents, and it's being investigated with, so far, very preliminary, but I would say encouraging results. The good thing of this is that it really blocks something that before these agents we couldn't block. So whether it's going to be the same story as EGFRs, we don't know. But now there's a lot of data indicating that when cells become resistant to an EGFR pathway, they may use as an alternative switch the IGFR1 pathway, because the cells are very plastic. Now they have this plasticity to, if you shut down this switch of the lights, they turn another one. So the IGFR1 will be. So that is one to watch, and the studies are really progressing. And obviously the c-MET inhibitors and several of these signaling pathways, I think this is the exciting part. Other agents, well, obviously there's a lot of new agents, but in terms of efficacy that our c-MET inhibitors have produced some responses too early.
What was your take on the presentation at ASCO looking at PCI in extensive small cell?
I was not surprised, because I always believed that, at least for CRs, I had always done it. From my old MD Anderson time, some of our physicians there were very negative on PCI and would not even give it to the complete responders. I had never had any catastrophic long-term side effects with cranial radiation. Therefore, I have done it, but I used to do it only for the limited disease, clear CR, young guy, etc. And I have several of these patients that have been cured, received it, and they were CEOs or whatever. They were high-level jobs, and they have been able to function. But I think it was good to see this data. I embraced it. I don't know what other people have done, but I embraced it because, in a way, it was not against my philosophy of treatment in small cell lung cancer. Although it's interesting to see that we have been trying to figure out all these things for many years, and like the adjuvant thing, and for many years, adjuvant in lung didn't work, and all of a sudden started working. And now the PCI seems to be something like that, something that never worked and all of a sudden started working. So I don't know if the trials are better designed now, or I don't know what's going on.
What about the issue of side effects with PCI? What do we know about that from the literature, and what's your own experience?
My own experience is not bad. However, what you need to ask is, what is the long-term experience? Because we radiate the brain many people, but most of them are people that live 3, 4, 5, 6 months. And they never go back to work and things like that. And you never really analyze how bad really this is. Now, when you see people with limited disease, small cell lung cancer, CR, you give PCI, and then they have to go back to work, and there are people with big jobs, like I have had, mostly from my MD Anderson experience, the ones that I radiated, I never saw anybody who was handicapped for life because of that. However, my colleagues there, some of them had seen maybe the other side of the story, and they were much more cautious. I personally have not seen it. I think now we'll see, as we do it more, how really relevant those delayed side effects are, which are the ones that obviously people are concerned. Summarizing, I think the three things that we're watching are the Olympus's frontline and the Avastin question that is important, the FLEX study with the Erbitux frontline. And I think the INTEREST trial is going to raise a lot of things when they publish it and you see all the results on the different subsets. It's going to force us to reanalyze all these predictors. And obviously the molecular part of all these EGFR mutations, this is continuing. And we are following this, but I think we need really prospective randomized evidence that these markers are important.